Hello and welcome to the Postmortem podcast, where we discuss hard problems and the lessons we can learn from them with engineers, industry leaders, and academics. My name is Francois and I'm an AI engineer. In today's episode, my guest is retired Colonel John Antal. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Francois. How are you?
Doing good, thanks. So Colonel John Antal is a retired US Army officer who served for 30 years in the US Army, commanding combat units from platoon to regiment level and serving in vital positions. His contributions have been recognized with several awards, including three separate awards of the Legion of Merit. In addition to his military and writing careers, Colonel Antal has also worked in the software industry. He worked with Microsoft and served as the executive producer and military advisor for Gearbox Software's Brothers in Arms games after retiring from the military. Throughout his career, Colonel Antal has made significant contributions to ensure the preparedness of the US Army and the allies, with particular focus on the integration of innovation from the civilian world, ranging from software, data and AI, and the use of off-the-shelf drones into military operations. He has written extensively on these topics, publishing 14 books, hundreds of magazine articles, and performing as many conferences. In his most recent book, Next War, Reimagining How We Fight, he analyzes lessons learned from recent wars and discusses how warfighting disruptors such as the use of AI embedded into systems are transforming warfare. As some of you may know, Colonel Antal has done several public conferences, lots of them available for free on YouTube. However, you'll find that this discussion will be very different from his previous public conferences because of the unique perspective we're going to approach with a deep dive into the specifics of AI, data processing, and the use of open source software impact on warfare. All the information used in this podcast comes from open source intelligence, material available directly and for free over the internet. And now for a discussion on AI and its impact on modern warfare with Colonel Antal. So Colonel, a first topic I'd like to cover with you is the role of AI in modern warfare more generally. And one question that came up when going over your book, Next War, is you go over a concept of man over the loop, man in the loop, when discussing AI applications. Could you elaborate on this concept and the implication for decision-making on the battlefield, especially in the case of split-second decision scenarios?
Yes, very good question. The way that AI is used in our culture today is not understood in a very general sense by many people. They look at AI almost as magic, and AI is not magic. Artificial intelligence has three major categories. The first is artificial narrow intelligence. And what that is the creation of programming systems, programming different types of code to get machines to do what we want them to do in a very narrow way. So, for instance, artificial narrow intelligence creates the ability for a calculator to calculate information for us at such rates that it's beyond human cognition, faster than we can think they can do these kind of things. But they cannot explain to you many other things because they are not the next step in artificial intelligence, which is artificial general intelligence. Now, artificial general intelligence is the ability to create an artificial intelligence that is equal to the human mind, that can actually think on its own. We don't have this today, but we're pressing the envelope, we're pushing the frontier of artificial intelligence now, and some people say we will have it sooner than most people think. That is an interesting idea, and it's almost, in some cases, disquieting, because the ability of a machine to think as well as a human being, of course, that takes a tremendous amount of energy to do that. What's amazing is that the human brain is the absolute best computer in the world for general things, getting things done, surviving in a tough environment, and it operates off of so little power that it's incredible. Now, to make an artificial general intelligence will require a lot of power, some very, very sophisticated programming that will build on it itself. And eventually, you will have this ability to come to a computer and you'll have the ability to talk to it as if it was a human being, and it will reply to you in actually creative and innovative ways. That's artificial general intelligence. Now, we don't have that yet. We may get there in the next decade. We may get there sooner than that, but we're not there yet. Now, the next step in artificial intelligence is what they call artificial superintelligence. And the idea there is that you would have 1, 2, 3, or 4 artificial general intelligences talking to each other and working out the next level of intelligence and creating the next level themselves. And since they don't sleep, they don't eat, everything else, you're providing them with the energy, then they could create in rapid time a superintelligence that, in fact, would be even more disheartening because now this superintelligence is what you see in the science fiction movies when they say, why do we need human beings anymore? You know, let's create Skynet or let's do the Matrix or whatever. So all of those things could happen, or good things could happen. We don't know. What's really interesting about technology is that so far, humanity's been able to make technology a tool. We've never become the slave of technology. Oh, until they made the smartphone. Now we're slaves. Yeah, but otherwise, we're pretty much in a situation where we control the technology. So good things could happen from artificial general intelligence. Imagine, for instance, an AGI that had the thinking ability of a very good doctor and became a brilliant doctor very quickly, became the smartest doctor in history and decided how a good cure for cancer or something else. So good things could come of this. Obviously, with any tool and with any cognitive system, it can be used for good or ill. So we're going to have to be careful on how this works, and we'll have to see what happens. But right now, we live in the world of ANI, Artificial Narrow Intelligence. And what that does, in many ways, if you wanted to look at what ANI is like, and this is a bad metaphor, but it works because people normally understand it. It is like an Excel spreadsheet. Okay, now this is a very crude example, and many programmers out there will take umbrage with me and say, oh my God, he doesn't understand, but if you're trying to explain artificial intelligence to people, you take a simple step, and one simple step is to say, okay, think of an Excel spreadsheet. You want to do something with numbers or words, and you put them in one column, and you put another column in to do something else with numbers and words, and if you can sync those things up, then you have some interesting abilities that can work at machine speeds, which means it can be extremely accurate and fast within its data set. Now, if its data is bad, it'll be inaccurate. But if its data is good, it will be accurate and fast. Now, think about this in military terms, which is what I talk about extensively with the military folks that are asking me questions about how wars will be fought and how the next war will be fought. The United States, China, and other nations are working to create a situation where artificial intelligence will help classify, coordinate, and synchronize long-range precision fires. So most soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who actually study war understand what a kill chain is. A kill chain is a series of events, normally with humans in many of the steps, that are able to get effects on target. So, for instance, a simple example is artillery fire as it was done, you know, for 100 years. We have a map. It can be on a screen or a piece of paper. It has coordinates. You see a target in the real world. You coordinate the target with the real world in the map. You call in the target, you call in the grid coordinates, and you ask for some kind of weapon to fire at it. And that weapon is usually an indirect weapon like a mortar or a howitzer or a rocket. That's a kill chain, and you go through the steps of that. The kill chain for a drone, let's say a high-altitude, long-endurance drone that has special weapons that is out to do a decapitation attack against an enemy leader, that takes a kill chain that may have political steps in it, where different lawyers and everyone else says, yes, do this, do that. Now, with artificial narrow intelligence, what we're trying to do with the kill chain is turn it into a kill web. Now, the name is different on purpose. A kill chain is human-centric. a kill web is AI-enabled. So without getting to artificial general intelligence or super intelligence or any sci-fi stuff, with what we have right now, you can, in fact, make the simple Excel spreadsheet of war. Imagine, for instance, a column that has every target that can be seen by every layered sensor from satellites on down to the ground. So you have satellites that can see things, and they can see things in five different ways if they're so equipped. Normally they see things in three or four of these. One is optical. In other words, great camera. I can read the license plate, you know, from a satellite. Okay? Cameras, optical. The next is thermal. Many of these satellites have the ability to see, or other sensors through the layer, all the way down from the stratosphere through the atmosphere to ground level. They see things with thermal vision, and they'll be able to see the difference between hot and cold, and therefore they can see hot spots moving on the battle space. The next is electromagnetic, and basically radio waves. So what you can do is you can see a complete, anyone who transmits on a radio, you can see where they're transmitting from. So if you imagine a military unit, it looks very interesting because the picture of its electromagnetic transmissions are the pictures of its command elements and everyone who has a radio and everyone who can talk electronically, digitally or through other means, you know, FM and things like that. So what you have is now three means. You have optical, thermal, and you have electrical. And so the next you go to is acoustic. Now, it's interesting. You remember, most of you will have heard stories or have a faint idea about in World War I and World War II, they had listening posts that would have sometimes big megaphone-like earpieces, and they would listen for sounds. Well, that is not as silly as it sounds. It is actually a very smart way. And in fact, human beings have been warned throughout our history by sound. If you heard the tiger growling in the weeds, you were smart not to rush in there and say hello. So the idea that you, in fact, can hear things in advance is important. So now we have drones and many, many types of small UAS and others that have acoustic sensors that can hear things. So if the artillery is shooting, now what you can hear is you can hear the sound of the guns and triangulate on them and have a very good location of where they are. And what's interesting about this is that sound detection is passive. So you don't have to send out anything. You just have to listen. You're just receiving. And so therefore, it's harder to counter. And then last is quantum. And quantum sensors are being developed. And the Chinese, for instance, have quantum radar that they're working on. The Russians have quantum radar that they're working on to see stealth aircraft. This is all right now pretty exquisite, and it is difficult and expensive. But eventually, it may come to a time when quantum sensors are thrown out in the battle space like snowflakes. And everywhere that these quantum sensors sense movement or a difference in magnetic field, they give off an alarm. And that could all be done in different ways. So imagine, again, this Excel spreadsheet that I was talking about. We're getting into artificial intelligence. You have all the sensors, layered sensors from space to the stratosphere to the atmosphere all the way down to ground level. And they are sensing targets, and they have good locations for those targets in the world. That's in one column. The next column is all of the weapon systems that you have that can hit those targets, that are in range of those targets, and that can defeat those targets. And this is all done in real time, like that. And then you decide in the other column how to attack it. Do I attack it all at once? Do I attack all these targets all at once? Do I attack, you know, one every minute? Do I attack them in a wave so that I hit the first ones up front, or do I hit the rear ones first? Or do I hit one a week? Whatever I want to do, that's what the third column could be. So that's a simple way of thinking about how artificial intelligence will impact war dramatically in the near future. And then if you tie that whole concept in of the kill web, and that's the kill web, the idea that sensors are linked to shooters, and those shooters and sensors are controlled by an artificial intelligence that can synchronize them in real time, which is a tremendous capability, then imagine what a powerful first strike you could launch. the first strike advantage is a hugely important capability.
Yeah, I wanted to circle back on this concept you mentioned of the kill chain against the kill web and the impact that data processing capabilities and using AI in this context could make in those split-second decisions where a human could just not compute all the information available to take the most appropriate actions. So in your opinion, can we envision winning conflict having maybe unconsciously chosen the man's loop approach in several Western countries against organizations that might fully opt in the fully autonomous AI paradigm that you just explained?
Well, good question. I think that all of the both systems, both a man in the loop and a man out of the loop approach, will always be used. Different weapon systems have different capabilities. Rifles will probably always be close to man in the loop, even if you have a computerized rifle system to help you aim. But if you look and a kill web, the artificial intelligence enabled kill chain that I call the kill web, is fragile because all those sensors working and all the computer systems working in order to make this happen so they can synchronize where all the weapons are that are within range that can destroy the target. Imagine the computer, what it does is it says, okay, I've got a tank. With 6 kilometers away, I've got an ATGM that's going to be launched from a helicopter that can hit it. And therefore, I'll give the signal to that helicopter to shoot that tank. Now, there's a human a little bit involved in that thing, or could not be, depending on how you want to do it. You could automate it, but nonetheless, there's humans involved in many of this. But the bottom line here is that what will happen is that as you start to degrade the enemy sensors, as you start to put chaos, confusion, and fog of war into the battle, the best kill web will be less and less capable. However, on the first strike, imagine if you were a nefarious dictatorship who wanted to seize an island somewhere in the Pacific, and you wanted to launch all sorts of missiles all at once against every enemy you perceived or envisioned, and you had a kill web, and you had your missile forces and aircraft forces and naval forces all set to execute the kill web while the enemy is not prepared, is in peacetime allocations and peacetime posture, and in fact is totally surprised. It makes Pearl Harbor look like an unplanned event. The United States, we remember that the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. Many people believed at that time that Pearl Harbor was too far away for anyone to attack. I just recently talked to an American senior officer who said the same thing. And I paused because I was incredulous. Because if I put you in charge of Red Forces and I said, I want you to figure out how to do a first strike against the American forces in the Pacific, you would figure out a way to attack Pearl Harbor. And the Japanese did in World War II. So just because the ranges of their missile systems, their most of their missile systems are intermediate, and only a portion of them are the longest range that can reach globally, that doesn't mean that you're in any kind of sanctuary. In fact, what it does mean is that there are no sanctuaries right now anywhere for military forces. And we just saw that. We just saw that with the recent attack by Iranian-backed proxies who killed three Americans and wounded 34 to more. And those soldiers were in a sleeping tent, which tells you many things. One, it tells you that tents don't protect you. Two, if you're in a war zone, you shouldn't be sleeping in tents in mass groups. And also, it tells you that there are no safe areas anywhere in any battle space. And anything can be the battle space, including the homeland. So we have to be very careful because if I put you in charge of Red Forces to attack Blue Forces in any scenario, in any war game scenario, you would use your imagination to figure out ways to do things that some people say are impossible.
So if we put into perspective the lesson you drawn from the Falcon conflict you studied to write Svelbux you did. There's several examples you mentioned, the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the Israel-Hamas conflict. And whenever we deep dive on one of those, we see that they bring new technique, new methods of warfare. But yet some of them, if I take the example in the Russian-Ukrainian conflict of the initial use of the Bayraktar drones, but they were really used in the early 2022 phase of the conflict, and then less and less due to appropriate countermeasures. And so it suggests that those learnings can, some of them, quickly become obsolete. And staying up to date is already increasingly changing. So especially for large organizations like state actors or NATO's allies. So what strategy do you believe could enable us to effectively adapt this continuous learning approach and identifying what are the long-lasting transformation and what are tools, gadgets that should not distract us from the deep transformation that are happening?
Yeah, very good. The most important thing for everyone to understand is although technology gives you great advantages, I mean, if you had the opportunity to fight with machine guns versus rocks, you would probably pick a machine gun if you were smart. So technology gives you great advantages, but there's no greater weapon on the battle space in the battle space than the human being. Humans can think, they're resilient, they can adapt, improvise, overcome. Machines can't do this. Machines are just tools that can be done. Now, when we start talking artificial general intelligence and artificial superintelligence, we're moving to a new level of machine. Again, we don't have those yet. And if we do get those anytime soon, their application will be probably very narrow. But, and except for superintelligence, but that probably won't happen for a long time. So the question is, you know, how do we adapt to the changing methods of war? And this is what I talk about. And this is why the books I've written, particularly the book on 7 Seconds to Die, which is about the Second Nagorno-Karabakh War. The Second Nagorno-Karabakh War is a war that we needed to study in depth, and too few people have. First of all, there is a cultural bias. Azerbaijan, Armenia, you got to be kidding me. Why should we pay attention to that? Those countries are both important. But there's an arrogance sometimes amongst folks that say, well, they're third-rate powers. They're not, you know, peer competitors like major European powers. On the other hand, if you actually study this and look at it, the Azerbaijanis did tremendous things. They were able to defeat the Armenians in 44 days of decisive combat. They used their robotic systems, primarily unmanned aerial systems, and systems like unmanned combat aerial vehicles like the Bayraktar TB2. They used those to the maximum and were able to, in very short order, win air dominance, destroy the enemy's command and control system, absolutely obliterate their artillery, EW, electronic warfare systems, then destroy their armor, then destroy their armored vehicles, then their wheeled vehicles, and then hunt troops. And about the middle of this war in October, it started in September 27th, and by the middle of October, the Azerbaijanis had run out of big targets and were hunting troops. So they had totally thrown the Armenians off their tipping point. Now, the Armenians were brave, and they fought hard, but it didn't matter, and that's when you have a decisive victory. So what the Azerbaijanis did was put together the perfect storm for Armenia, and they used some of the highest, most expensive technology they could buy, and since they were flush with oil money from the Baku oil fields and other oils that they have, they were able to buy this from Israel and other places, and Turkey, and they were able to put this together in a way that totally tipped the Armenians, and they never recovered. The Armenians were never able to recover totally. So the war lasted. The war was not won only by robotic systems. It took Azerbaijani soldiers to fight battles and Armenians to defend, and humans were crucial in this. It wouldn't have been a decisive victory. It would have been a technological stalemate had not the human elements been involved, and particularly the final attack on Shusha, which was the center of gravity and also the decisive terrain of the Second Nagorno-Karabakh War. Very seldom do you have the decisive terrain also be the center of gravity. Now, those are two very important and distinct military terms. The center of gravity, of course, is if you take this, everything else falls. And the decisive terrain is similar. If you take this terrain, everything else falls. So very seldom is that the same. But Shusha was, in fact, the center of gravity and the decisive terrain of Nagorno-Karabakh. And when the Azerbaijanis were able to seize it in an infiltration attack, and that's interesting. You see, if we had studied this war, we would have learned so much about how war is going to proceed in Ukraine and other places. Why did they do an infiltration attack? Why not massed armored formations and troops marching in formation, you know? Why not the coming up in column and just overwhelming the enemy? Because today, with long-range precision fires, even the ones that Armenia had, even the ones that were so disrupted toward the end of the war, Armenia could still put devastating fire on massed formations. So one of the challenges of modern war is how do you mass on a transparent battle space? The Ukrainians tried to break through this last summer. They were heroic and brave, and they did everything we had taught them to do. We taught them in the old way. And unfortunately, they died in the old way. And what has to happen is we have to think differently about warfare. We should have known this from the Second Nagorno-Karabakh War. But we have many military leaders who think in the old way because that's the way they know. It is very difficult. It is very difficult to change your thinking. You have to read. You have to study. You have to debate. You have to actually practice some of this stuff and train and do some experimentation. And all of this needs to be done in rapid order in order to meet the changing methods of war. Now, why is war changing so fast? It's because technology is aiding warfighters in new ways never before seen. Technology is moving, as you know, at an accelerated rate. I mean, in 1999, we did not have a smartphone. And now we have everything. I mean, that we didn't have then. And all of those things, certainly because of the commercialization of this technology, continues to cascade in rapid order.
Yeah, and circling back on the idea you mentioned of how hard is it to train for this new conflict, new war, what are your views and how is it possible to incentivize allied troops and commanding officers to experiment with new learning approach, learning in degraded environments, not to rely on exquisite platforms or best material available, but to develop on cheap and commercially available off-the-shelves capabilities, maybe repurposed, and start to instill this mindset of using what's available instead of the best material that you won't always get?
Right. That's always the tough question that I get from soldiers and Marines in particular today. They say, well, I don't have anything like you're talking about. For instance, you say you should use decoys, but I don't have any decoys. And so I tell them, don't tell me what you can't do. Tell me what you can do. Start thinking. He who thinks wins. What do you mean you don't have any decoys? Make them up. I mean, what is a thermal decoy? A thermal decoy is something that looks hot in a cold environment, cold background. Can you make that? Well, it's called a fire. Okay, so what if you were to put a smudge pot together, a tin can, with some sand and rocks, and put some oil in there and light it, and put it off far to your left? In the middle of the night, the enemy's going to see this warm area to the left. Drones are not that smart right now. They're flying at night. They're going to see a hot spot. They might attack it. They might report on it. They might call artillery fire on your smudge pot. This is an old trick. This has been done for years. You just have to use your brains. We have to start thinking more. So human beings are amazingly flexible and adaptable, and they are creative in ways that are amazing. For instance, if you wanted to give one word to the Ukrainian way of war, what would it be? I think it would be innovation. They have innovated and continue to innovate because they're forced to. It's innovate or die. Now, they need help. They need as much support as we can give them, and we should give them more. And we should stop dribbling it out. We need to give it to them in greater numbers, and we need to not stop worrying about trying to incrementalize everything. An incremental approach to warfare is a sure way to end up in a stalemate. And that occurs in every war. Now, most wars start off fast and end up in positional warfare. Most wars end up in positional warfare. It takes either a unique method or brilliant generalship to break the positional warfare. Unique methods are rare, and brilliant generals are even more rare. So our challenge is that, you know, there are only so many Napoleons and only so many Julius Caesars. And so you end up with positional warfare in most wars. And if you study war, you'll know this. You see it. I mean, World War I was not because the generals were stupid. It was just that they weren't smart enough to figure out how to get around it. And when they finally did, it was already 4 years of fighting. I mean, they developed the technological means to do it. And you see how fast warfare, for instance, accelerated during World War I. They started off in colorful uniforms with cavalry, and they ended up with tanks and tanks and airplanes and gas warfare and rapid-firing artillery. So things happen quickly. World War II, even more so. You start off with biplanes in some cases, and you end up with jets and the atomic bomb. And that was, from 1939 to 1945. So very short period of time, a lot of acceleration happens. Human beings have to be able to adjust to that and adapt quickly.
A great example of acceleration that you also mentioned in your books and conferences is the Guardian of the World operation. So it was the Israel-Hamas conflict of 2021, and it was often described as the first war won by AI. So it was basically a coordinated response of Israel within minutes after Hamas strikes by processing data from multiple sources to get what could be a common operation picture in near real time and quickly engage Hamas. So, I mean, it was really depicted as a mark of advanced processing, the strong cyber capability of Israel and the use of AI to massively process this stream of information, identify patterns and suggest course of actions. Yet, when we look at the recent history, the attacks of Hamas of October 2023 and the surprise it was for the Israeli Defense Forces, it can be surprising to see that despite having such a strong intelligence gathering, information processing capabilities, such events could be missed. So when you see those events and the IDF surprise to this attack, what are your thoughts on the use of multi-domain data gathering and synthesis tools in warfare and their limits?
Yeah, that's the question every military professional should be asking, and government leader. The Israelis fought the Israeli-Hamas War of 2021 to a victory in 11 days. They were able to track the leadership of Hamas into the metro and destroy them in the metro, many of them in the metro. They were able to do this for a lot of reasons, one of which is the use of personal phones. So there's a lesson there, isn't there? I mean, it's a good thing that in the French Army and the American Army and the British Army, we don't let our soldiers take personal phones to the field. Oh, wait a minute. We need discipline. There's a place called Makivka in the Donbass, in the Donetsk region, that the Russians had over 400 some mobilniks, mobilized troops, put into this building overnight for a New Year's Eve before they were going to be sent out to their units. And they were using their smartphones and their cell phones to call home and wish everyone Happy New Year. And the Ukrainians found them and killed them. Now, we don't know exactly how many were killed, but the Russians admit that it was the greatest loss of life in one single day that they've had so far, which is kind of amazing because they've had some pretty bad fights on both sides. But and of course, the Russian General Staff and the Russian Officer Corps immediately said, well, we told the soldiers what to do. It's their fault. Whenever you hear that, just realize that is an absolute lack of leadership. You know, you told them what to do, but you didn't supervise. You told them what to do, but you didn't come down there and make sure that your orders were obeyed. You are a leader, right? I mean, that's the problem with this kind of stupidity. And it goes across all forces. So we need to learn from these things. But what the Israelis did was they learned the wrong lessons from the Israeli-Hamas war of 2021. They came out of the war believing our technology is so superior, they can't do anything. We can mow the grass whenever we want. We'll keep putting everything into our technology because they can't adapt. And we're doing fine. This will work. Now, they're not the only nation in the world that has hubris. You know, we just recently fled from Afghanistan in a unbelievably despicable way. And where is the after-action review on that, and who was held accountable for that disaster? No one. So our challenge is that, you know, the Israelis, the Americans, all these folks, the Russians, the Chinese too, everybody has, it's human nature. We have got to get better leaders to be able to look at these things. And one of the ways you do that is you red team these situations. In other words, you war game them, playing the role of the enemy. Now, after the 2021 Israeli-Hamas war, the Israelis should have said, okay, I'm Hamas. I just lost a whole bunch of leaders, and in 11 days they were suing for an armistice. They're not going to give up. You know, we don't see them flocking to the negotiation table as much as we would like to. So what are they going to do next? How would you, if you were the Hamas leader, how would you do this? Well, the high tech didn't work. So how about a low tech approach? Interesting. Now, if you look back at this, you could see it clearly that they learned, Hamas adapted, improvised, and overcame their problems. They were weak in areas where they could be strong in others, and it was an asymmetric approach to coming through. They picked a time when they could surprise the Israelis. Their timing was decisive. Their methods were imaginative, and the Israelis would have been better off in 1948 defending against this kind of an attack than they were today. Why is that? And it's because they put too much faith in their technology. In 1948, the Israelis were in Nakal and Kibbutzim settlements. Everybody had a weapon. Everybody had a place to go and fight if there was the alarm was sounded. Everybody would rush out and were organized to defend the perimeter. A few years ago, the Israelis decided none of their citizens should have guns. They took all their guns away in the good European fashion. And so the Israelis were sitting there in their settlements without many weapons, and they were not prepared to defend.
Well, that's very interesting, because what you just mentioned here on the prepared citizenry, I think it's relevant of what we can depict as the impact of non-traditional actors in warfare that we are seeing a resurgence of. I mean, Ukraine saw the rise of NGO, non-government organization like Aero Rosica, which basically presents itself as an NGO helping Ukrainian troops with drones, software development, cybersecurity expertise. Even if the effective operational impact is hard to measure, those non-traditional actors are combining expertise they have on maybe in their daily life, in their civic life of software engineering, building, adapting, and delivering capabilities, and this time to deliver new payload, maybe in the information or kinetic warfare. So what I find interesting in today's world, where with cloud compute capabilities like Amazon Web Service, Google Cloud, Microsoft Azure, you can basically ship software and data processing capabilities everywhere. There's open source software projects on GitHub that you can fork and adapt for use case, machine learning models available for free on the internet. You've got network capabilities that are very hard to jam, Starlink. It's just basic consumer stuff everyone can buy now. So someone with the appropriate set of technical skills can build and deploy capabilities tailor-made for one emerging use case on the field and deliver it to the world warfighters in maybe hours, days. So what does it make you think about in terms of the non-traditional actors like NGOs, prepared citizenry, or anyone contributing to a conflict can now impact beyond its initial means?
Right. Another good question. Never underestimate your enemy. People think, and they think better than machines. And they'll come up with ways to create new networks, new software, new kind of things. Now, their software may be wetware. It may just be brain power put together in a new way. But the bottom line is that they can do this in many different ways if they are forced to. In Somalia, we were up against an intelligence network back in the 90s that was completely run by mobile phones, and we didn't have the means at that time to track them and hunt them down or anything like that. And so suddenly when Black Hawks were going into Mogadishu, everybody in the world knew where they were, and they were being reported on by children and everyone else who were out there on the rooftops, you know, with being basically island watchers, as we did in World War II, or coast watchers in England in the Blitz. So networks can be created with all sorts of computers, particularly the human mind, which is the best computer out there. Now, there are some interesting examples in the Ukrainian fighting of how software is being used to speed up the sense and strike capability, particularly of Ukrainian systems, because they have to build almost everything from scratch being invaded. They weren't in a full-scale war prior, although they were fighting since 2014. That fighting had been relatively restricted to the Donbass and had been slow-moving in many cases, so that it was more positional. But once the invasion occurred in February of 2022, then what happened was the whole country got mobilized, and part of that was the mobilization of drones in the Erosovitska organization, which was a hobby group that put together drones for use for both ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, and strike. And all of this has now grown into a huge industry in Ukraine, because they can put drones together and manufacture different parts for drones and things a lot easier than you can tanks. I mean, drones that cost less than $1,000, you know, can destroy a tank if utilized properly. So first-person view drones being flown by dedicated operators. And by the way, those operators have to be well-trained. You do not have a good drone force without good drone operators right now. Someday, they may be fully autonomous and only may need to be turned on and turned off. But that is not today yet. So when you look at the French Army, the British Army, the American Army, any army in NATO, how many drone operators do they have? The Ukrainians are losing 10,000 drones a month. 10,000 drones a month. Some of those are ISR drones that are knocked down or just break down or hit a tree or whatever. You know, the wind hits them and they crash into the side of a hill. Or not so much hills in Ukraine, but, you know, they crash somewhere. Or they're shot down, or they're kamikaze drones. But 10,000 a month, that means you've got to have how many operators? Well, maybe not 10,000 operators, but some thousands of operators. Was it 3,000? Is it 4,000? So how many operators, small UAS operators, are in the French Army? You know, and how many small UAS operators are in the American Army? And I will tell you, nowhere near what we will need to fight the next war. Now, there's other software development that's going on in Ukraine, which is very interesting, and that goes with the artillery system that they have, which is similar to the Waze driving program that you may be familiar with. In the U.S. in particular, Waze, W-A-Z-E, is a crowdsource-like information system. So you're driving down the highway and someone will say an accident at this place. And sure enough, on your screen will show a dot where the accident is, and people report it. Well, the Ukrainians created a much more sophisticated system, but they did it on the cheap. They did it with software developers right there called Kropiva. And this system basically helps them get effects on target, either artillery or mortars or rockets or drones or even air on target by being able to say this is where the Russians are and kill them. And it's not exactly like Waze, but it has some similar capabilities, similar features. So that is interesting because, for instance, the United States and NATO is spending billions of dollars to create the same system. Now, that doesn't mean that that system is bad, stupid, or whatever. The system the United States is working on is called JADC2, Joint All Domain Command and Control system. And that, of course, is top down. So, you know, we've got to make sure that it's super secure and everything else. But by the time you get it down to the soldier, it often seems not to work. Whereas this one in Ukraine was bottom up. Now, bottom up, top down, depends on what you're working on. Neither one is better than the other if, in fact, they work. if they'd ever get done and only spend money and never work, well, then it's something to make bad jokes about. So we have challenges in that if you're going to be controlling national systems like from the United States, the idea that you would grow this system out of a Waze system from bottom up, maybe not the smart way to go. However, it does show you innovation, and it does show you the ability to use what you have rather than complain about what you don't have. And so they created this system, and it works for them. Now, can it get better? Sure. But it works right now, and it is something to think about, and it's an example of innovation in the tech arena.
We've seen a lot of examples of the rapid rise of private entities in both the software and hardware sectors that you just discussed, promising to deliver innovative solutions where traditional defense industry players some have struggled to come up with new ways to equip our warfighters. So in the West, we've got plenty of companies such as Anduril, Shields AI, Sage, Aperius, Lambda Automata that are pioneering new defense products. And now we also have venture capital that is becoming more increasingly willing to fund this defense project, which is something different from 10 years ago. So in terms of balance between the public innovation and private innovation, do you think that what would be the part of data processing capabilities and actual tech and innovation should be completely outsourced to private entities, and which are the expertise and capabilities that you think should be kept within the forces to better understand and leverage the potential opportunities that are seen on the field?
Right. It is never a question of either or. It's always a question of both. There are some things that a hierarchical government-led organization can do better, some things they cannot. An example. As you're well aware, in the first weeks of the Ukrainian invasion, the Russians did a first strike against the Ukrainians. Now, they fired over 2,149 targets in this first strike, with long-range precision fires, and most of them hit their target. However, the way that the Russians had planned this was based on their perception of what the war would be like. They felt that the war would be simply slapping their little cousins around and getting them to fall in line, and they would all just obey because they really are Russians and they love Putin. Well, guess what? That didn't happen. So that first strike was not strong enough, and by the way, the Chinese have seen that. So when they do their first strike, they will put everything into it. And so will the North Koreans, and so will the Iranians if they ever have to do that. Everyone who has a brain knows now that the first strike cannot be halfway. Okay, so technology, government-centric or business. So what happened was that Ukraine couldn't communicate because the Russians destroyed their communication systems and their cell towers. Most of them, many of them. And disrupted with jamming and other things, their other means of communications. Until Elon Musk came in with Starlink. And in 2-3 weeks, almost everybody in the Ukrainian army had a Starlink receiver. And you cannot block Starlink from the satellite unless you get in between the satellite and the receiver. Now you can find out where the Wi-Fi is emitting from the Starlink receiver, because it's just a signal, and then you got to Wi-Fi it out. So that's how they detect it today, and they changed their thinking about the Russians on how to find it, but that just means you have to shoot and scoot. You have to can't stay in one place very long because their reaction time isn't very fast. But the bottom line here is, again, that had the United States government been given the mission to put 5,000 Starlink satellites into low Earth orbit and the money, we'd still be working on the first launch. Whereas SpaceX has done it. Elon Musk has done it. And the Chinese are agog. They look at this and they go, oh my God, this is a threat. Look at that, 5,000 low Earth orbit satellites, CubeSats out there, all communicating. And now we're making Starshield for the defense industry, which is a hardened version. So it scares the heck out of our enemies. But the United States government could never have done that in time. I mean, just imagine if the United States government or the French government, any government, We want you to make a smartphone. Here, it's 2002. Here's some money. Go build it. How long would it take and what would it look like?
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be incredible. So we can do many things with well and faster and better with commercial industry because they're in a battle every day. They're in a battle of the market. And they see what wins or loses every day. You know, if you want to sell beer, you better sell beer to the right people the right way. Otherwise, you're going to lose a tremendous amount of money if you sell it in the wrong way, if you follow me. So the bottom line is that they're in a battle every single day, and they have to win or lose. So therefore, they can learn from all this, and they can create a red team-like effect where they learn what works. And because they're also, in many cases, privately owned, they can decide to go off and do something, like Anduril. Anduril is an amazing company that is making drones for the United States. And that's because Palmer Luckey, the CEO, is a brilliant guy who wants to do this. But, you know, had a government agency been asked to do some of this, who knows what we've come up with. However, you couldn't make the atomic bomb in World War II without a government agency. You couldn't create huge projects that involve a lot of national investment. You couldn't make the Maginot Line. Well, maybe we shouldn't have. But anyway, the point is that the national government can create some things that are very, very important to be able to do this. But in this day and age, it would be interesting to see what the percentage would be. For instance, in the 1920s, I mean, we're talking ancient history here, but 1920s, maybe it was 80% or 90% national government and 10%, you know, innovation from outside world. Although that's always something you can talk about, because I could, for instance, balloons. Governments didn't come up with aerial balloons. And here we are in the Civil War and suddenly they got balloon corps. Where'd those balloons come from? Well, the government didn't have a plan to build them. You know, commercial industry built them, or, you know, people, inventors. So now maybe it's the other way. Maybe it's 80-10, 80-20, I mean, or 90-10 to what it should be for commercial and a government. But either way that you look at it, we need both. And our challenge with government processes is that it takes a long time. It's bureaucratic. We have what we basically call a 10-12-year cycle. Can't get a weapon system done for 10 years. We can't do that anymore. We're in an era of prototype warfare. We have to be able to organizationally and equipment-wise field units with new prototypes, use them, and then when they are no longer the thing, they're no longer the most important system anymore because they've been overcome, get new equipment and start with a different innovation. The Barakhtar TB2 is a good example. Barakhtar TB2 was the darling of the Second Nagorno-Karabakh War. The Azerbaijanis, with the great help of Turkey, were able to use the Barakhtar TB2 to dominate the skies, along with a lot of Israeli loitering munitions like the Harop and the Orbiter. But the Barakhtar TB2 gave them high-resolution optical and other sensor capability, and the ability to launch missiles from its wings, although it only had a few hard points, and those were proprietary to the Turkish missile development. So you could only put Turkish missiles on it. They sold these to Ukraine, of course, before the Russian invasion. The Ukrainians had anywhere between 20 to 30, depending on what numbers you see in open sources. And how many of those were operational is hard to believe. It was probably in the dozens, you know, probably 12, maybe 15 were operational when the war started, maybe less. But anyway, those few that were there did tremendous work until they ran out of missiles, like in the first 2 weeks. Then they asked Turkey for more missiles, and Turkey was having negotiations with Russia, and those missiles didn't come. And then America had to come in and other folks from England, and they had to put new hardpoints on the TB2 so you could get some kind of missiles there. But the TB2 was an aircraft designed with a certain aerodynamics, and you could only have a missile of a certain weight. So all of those things happened. So they started to use the TB2 more in an ISR fashion. But it wasn't just the missiles. It was also that the fact that the Russians, you know, coordinated and consolidated their integrated air defense system better once they realized the invasion wasn't going to work with their plan to like be an octopus and seize everything all at once. So they fled back to the east. And when that happened, you had a dense integrated air defense system where the Barakhtar TB2 just didn't operate as well. But a good example of prototype warfare. Worked well in the Second Nagorno-Karabakh War, worked well in the opening months of the Ukrainian War, and not so much after, without adaptation. So now to make the Barakhtar TB2 still viable, because the system has some credit, you know, it has some ability, it has a few years left on it, I guess, you have to think of different ways to mask its ability to move on this on the battle space. Now, masking is a very important concept that all of your listeners should understand. It is not a principle of war. As you know, different nations have different principles of war. And these are supposed to guide you in how you think. Unfortunately, sometimes they shackle you as well. You have to be open-minded with these things and principles of war. Now, masking is not a principle of war. I think it should be for the 21st century. But masking is the full-spectrum, multi-domain effort to deceive enemy sensors and disrupt enemy targeting. Deceive their sensors and disrupt their targeting. It's not deception at the level of Operation Overlord on D-Day with rubber tanks and all this other stuff. It is masking all the way down to the squad level, where you put up a dummy, you know, 30 feet from you so the enemy will shoot at this stick with a helmet on it. Where you make a smudge pot and put it out as a decoy, where you figure out how to camouflage, you figure out how to reduce your thermal signature, you figure out how to reduce your electronic signature. So masking is crucial, deceiving their sensors. And then how do we disrupt their targeting? Every targeting system has a kill chain, like I explained earlier. That kill chain has steps. What are the steps of the enemy's kill chain? We should know that. They're not secret. You can figure it out. They're general, just like ours are. You have to have someone observe the target. That sensor has to report the information. The information has to be calculated to be correct and approved. And then you have to make sure you have designated a system that's within range that can kill it to fire at it. That's a kill chain. Lay all those steps out, then figure out the best way to disrupt the enemy's kill chain. And some of those systems are more exotic than others. So it's a good way to figure out what's going on. But if you've never done that level of understanding and thinking, well, then you're not very professional. You're not a very professional soldier in my mind, because you haven't thought it through. I mean, lives depend on leadership and what you do. And if you don't know this, then who does? And who's, you know, do you have to wait for someone to tell you? We need more people to think. Again, he who thinks wins. So I think that is a roundabout way to talk about how technology prototype warfare is upon us now, and we have to really learn how to do this. We have to learn how to see what the need is, field something that is good enough in the numbers that are necessary, and remember that everything that's too expensive, you know, has a different impact. I mean, if you're going to field something that has to be fielded in mass, but you can only field two or three, it may not have the impact you want. You know, so if you have to field hundreds or thousands of something, you've got to keep the price point down. And especially if they're disposable. For instance, all of the things that we've been talking about with decoys, we need a whole series of decoys that are disposable. So why don't we have more disposable decoys so that soldiers could pull them out of their pocket, turn them on, and throw them in the ground? And then walk 15 miles away or whatever, and then the enemy sees that and they go, aha, that's where they are, and they just killed a bunch of $4 sensors. So all those kind of things are stuff that we need to be thinking about.
Yeah, thanks so much for raising awareness on this concept of prototype warfare, that I find very interesting to know where to put this cursor between innovation in-house and using off-the-shelf components, and to quickly probe on what should be the area of focus. Thanks so much, sir, for your time and this deep conversation. Really enjoyed it. And I'd like to note that all the resources we discussed, the books, the reference, will all be in the show notes for the audience to go in depth. And I thank you very much.
Well, Well, thank you very much, Francois. It has been an honor to talk with you and your audience. And I hope that those of you get a chance to look out and check out 7 Seconds to Die or Next War will be able to learn from it, to be able to think and adapt in time so that we can create a deterrent that causes no need for war because the enemy knows they can't win. That's our ultimate goal. But if you have to fight, then you better fight to win. Thank you very much. You have a great day.
Thank you very much.